Welcome to the Mug Meeting Summaries Podcast. I'm Gilbert Dutilleux. Our January meeting started with the usual roundtable session, which featured topics such as lightweight alternatives to GNOME or KDE, clock issues with virtualized Linux, feedback on the last newsletter, routing quirks in Linux, and multi-booting under EFI.
I have Freedom Good Home, a Spark Server 10. I do have the root password. It has two external hard drives and an external floppy, or an external CD-ROM. So Freedom Good Home. See you at the break.
What's the
spec on the cover? 2Z55.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, wrong. No.
Yes,
Dan. It does boot, and I have the root password. So.
I am. Yes.
We're just assuming it started at this point.
So, anyone else with questions, comments? Kevin.
I have a question for Sean. I saw your tweets about the Unity 3D.
Yeah.
Thing on towards the end of this month.
Mm-hmm.
So, are you going?
My brother might be. Oh. Mm-hmm. I went to the first one. I took my brother to that.
Yeah.
And then they're a good bunch of guys.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you're interested in learning to use that tool, you're definitely the people to speak to.
You might go, or you're not going to?
I probably won't this month. I'm way over.
Are you actually familiar with C Sharp? Or?
Mildly. Enough to break stuff.
Just curious. I might go. I'm excited.
Okay.
Just sounds like fun.
It is, and they're a bunch of good guys.
Dan, you had a comment earlier? No?
Yeah, Winnipeg's at 3-2.
Winnipeg?
Go Jets, go!
Oh.
we are happy when the games are not in town.
Exactly. Nice.
Yeah.
The parking was a lot easier than I
thought.
What's a Jet?
Okay, my question, has anybody used the Trinity desktop?
Trinity desktop.
It's a KDE 3.5 fork. Apparently it's compatible with the GNOME 2 programs and KDE 4 programs, as well as KDE 3 programs. Apparently, it's very much lighter weight, and it pretty much follows the KDE 3.5 way of doing things. I was looking at it as an alternative to GNOME 3 and KDE 4 on Mint 12.
Mint's got a new desktop now, Cinnamon.
Yes, I was not able to get it running. And it turns out with the Trinity, going back to that for a second, I tried it at home on my Mint 10 box, and also at the lab with the Mint 12 box, and it seems there's a problem with the locale. I was able to get two out of the four repositories to come down, but not the other two. And they keep complaining about not finding anything with an EN-CA, but for some reason, you know, I don't know why, the main set of programs aren't there. All the additional stuff is there, but not the main stuff.
Bleeding edge.
It's been around for a couple of years. Yeah.
If you're looking for lighter weight, I've been happy with XFCE and Sawfish as the window manager setting.
XFCE is okay.
Oh, yeah, but this is supposed to be going out to people who've never used computers before.
Oh, okay.
Then why not just stick with GNOME 3?
Well, these are older machines.
It didn't work out of the box on mine.
Didn't work out of the box on mine either, so.
The latest, the more recent XFCE is supposed to be pretty easy to use.
Mm. Yeah, I liked it when I had it running on my machine at home.
Kevin, you've had your hand up or out?
Yes, I actually had a real technical question. At work, we are running a bunch of VMs running on VMware ESX. There was one in particular that a coworker drew my attention to because he noticed something weird. It's running Ubuntu 10.04.
Ubuntu what, sir?
10.04. And for some reason, he decided to run top. And it's a dual CPU configured with two CPUs. And when he ran top, depending on which mode Top was in, sometimes it listed like the first two or three or four processes sorted in order of CPU usage were at 99.9%, including Top itself. And when you switch to the other mode, some of the processes would be at like 3,700% CPU utilization or 7,200, like super ridiculous numbers. And
yep.
Has anyone seen that?
You have dynamic load management turned on in VMware.
Yeah. And do you have VMware tools installed?
VMware tools is installed.
That for 10.04?
You mean dynamic resource scheduling? Or?
No. Dynamic power management.
Oh, dynamic power management. I don't think we do use that.
Okay.
Changing the clock.
Yeah.
We don't use that.
Sure. Are you running ESX 4 or 5?
4.
Oh, but you're definitely not using it. Okay.
Are your tools up to date?
Yes, because the machine is not in production yet.
Have some slicing work to give you part of it?
Just been installed.
Yeah, but it didn't fool the client. Pardon me, it didn't fool the client like that.
Oh. Would it have anything to do with time synchronization?
It could. Actually, that's one thing to try is just HZ equals 10. Was it 10 or 1,000? I can't remember which way you're supposed to go.
Down.
So set like HZ equals 100 on the kernel command line.
Yeah.
That might solve some of your problems. Not should be a big deal because 10.04 I think was already a tickless kernel anyway. The other thing to check is. Just lost my train of thought. I'll let you know when I remember.
Okay.
We have problems. I don't remember the version numbers. We had problems in older versions. ESX running tickless kernels. It didn't work well with them. We found better results with cutting the clock tick down to a lot lower hertz.
I hadn't seen. We'd like to use Ubuntu on some other machines, but I haven't seen that.
Are you seeing like the software that it's saying is run is taking up so much CPU, is it actually running slowly? Are you seeing a performance
if you use the graphs in the vCenter client directly connecting to the server, it doesn't show CPU like maxed out or anything. It just shows sort of normal what you'd expect, hardly doing anything. So it doesn't reflect what Top is reporting. Top is like totally out of whack.
Have you tried any alternatives to Top?
No, I was considering that. What would you recommend?
What's the
I couldn't remember what they were called, actually.
Uptime.
Well, that would be worth checking, just out of curiosity. Yeah.
VMstat. VMstat.
VMstat.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
Try maybe just using PS with 20 options.
Yeah.
Which?
PS with 20 options.
Yeah.
Yeah, one thing, though, I have got a Macintosh at home. I tried PS in extern, like PS-A, and it hung on me. So it did that sometimes. I was wondering why it would do that, unless I picked up a virus or something.
No, it's BSD and not a Linux, so the PS minus A, the minus A is the part that's not working.
Take out the dash.
Yeah. And use it as, I guess, okay. Not VSD, but
take out the dash.
Yeah.
One more question about the virtual thing. Mm-hmm. When you use Top, does it accurately report when you choose that option the correct number of CPUs that you've actually given in the VM?
Actually, it's like the VM is configured with two CPUs, and you can tell Top to show per CPU, and it shows two CPUs.
Okay.
And actually, the numbers up there, like it's really just in the list of processes where it's wrong. Because if you look at the CPU utilization in the one or two lines for the two CPUs combined or separately, it's actually reporting it correctly there. It's just in the process list that shows these processes.
I know what I was going to say. The last Ubuntu box I saw that exhibited just random weirdness. Wasn't that exact symptom, but it was similarly bizarre behavior, it was infected by a rootkit. So that's something to check anyway.
Strange behavior under Windows VMs. If you actually reconfigured the VM to increase the CPU count, it actually did cause it to behave very poorly, extremely slow. Where in this case, it was showing no CPU use, but extremely slow. So if it was readjusted halfway through, I don't know what Ubuntu would do.
just see what happens and set up straight through it.
Yeah. I'll have to see if some other any other VMs or just that one.
I just load a brand new VM OPS and see what it does. Yeah. I'm gonna take you 10 minutes.
Okay, thanks.
Because then you'll know you have an uninfected. Again, if you pull away off of it.
Well, yeah, like the source and the not actually connected to the network.
Mm-hmm.
I got two books, or a set of books, from Wikipedia. It's called Pedia Press. It's Internet Protocols. It's the whole Internet Protocols category off of Wikipedia.
Oh, my
two volumes. Cost me $150 with color. But I'll pass the first book around. Please don't lose my place. But take a look. If they're, honestly, I've had it for about a week now, a little under.
What page is it?
It's... 96. Well, it's worth it's worth reference material. So, I thought I'd share that.
$150
for two of those, yeah. 800 pages, man, in color.
Oh. Is that also part of the donation to Wikipedia, or is that?
10% goes to Wikipedia, and then the rest covers the cost of printing it and then shipping it from the UK.
From the UK.
So it's just a printout of the Wikipedia page? Not just printout. It actually goes through and grabs all the pages, formats the headers properly, like it does all the nice formatting, and then also all the links. So like if, say, TCP/IP links to IP address, an article on that, it actually gives you a reference number, which is congruent with the reference number in the book. So you can actually go, oh, I want to know more about that. Look at the index. Oh, it's over there. So it actually follows quite nice.
This reminds me strongly of buying enormous tomes in the mid-90s that were simply all the RFCs printed out.
Yeah, but this
except
is just one
with
of
color.
They usually didn't have good indexes.
And presumably decent pictures.
But you did it right.
Yes.
I just like to make a comment about our newsletter. The electronic format is great, and I think that we should include a feature every month of featured tech video, because the video reference that was in this month's was excellent. The one on the future of computing. The gentleman talked about buying his own satellite system to do his distribution and stuff. Mm-hmm. It was just an excellent video. It was unbelievable. I would have never found it on my own.
Was it the doctoral video?
Probably.
I think it was on the third page. Near the bottom. I can't remember because I don't have a copy because it's electronic.
And I don't have any spare copies.
I don't remember what ended up on the third page by the time I was done with it all.
Uh-huh. Oh, I keep pressing the link of my paper copy.
But the scrolling works well.
Pages turn really smoothly.
Computing. Yeah.
I actually have a technical question. Who was in the video? Who was giving us
the The gentleman who did the video, I got the impression that he was a rock musician of some sort. that was very knowledgeable about very knowledgeable about the internet and how it works and where it was going in the future.
Steve is our honorary archivist.
I noticed this actually the other day. I don't know if it's my box. I haven't looked into that much, but I don't know if it's my asterisk box or the firewall, the BSD box. I had never noticed it before, but when it goes to register on the IX side to the provider, it actually gets a note back in the log saying, okay, it sees me as this address, blah, 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 whatever, right? No problem. No message waiting. Next one. it flips over to this 29, and it flips back to the actual static, original static IP. It goes back and forth every registration process. I'm thinking, what the heck?
Have you seen that before?
Is this a firewall loop or a construct? Is she hashing? Is she? It's like, what?
Do you have masquerading or anything like that on?
It's a BSDPF rule. We are NATing in there, but it passes all traffic defined for those subnets through.
Right, so it's got its own static IP in the world.
Yeah.
So for some reason, it's actually good. The only thing I thought of, it could be an even name daemon issue because we have external and internal names defined. And the internal one, if it actually goes to, the, say, the internal address before, instead of actually going to the external one, maybe it's put back and forth between that. Just a guess. But there's one way to find out, get rid of the internal address and just see if it actually is forcing it through.
I was just going to suggest that, yeah.
Just see if it always went that way. But why would it be flip-flopping? No, if it's a name game issue, why would it be flip-flopped to the internal?
You would expect it would cache that on one side, and so it shouldn't keep going back and forth. But I don't
know. Sounds more like a protocol
like
issue than
talking about two machines.
More in general purpose computing. In this case, there's one machine that I'm looking at. One machine.
So it flip-flops between the actual public IP and the public
and
IP
the
of the firewall?
Right, the other one, yeah, the firewall.
We're running NAT, so yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, by definition, that means that some of your packets are meeting the NAT rule when they shouldn't be.
Yeah, and I guess the thing is, though, it's got a public address, and the PF rules are very clear over anything with this IP address just let through.
Does the asterisk box have more than one IP?
Yeah.
It's internal and external.
Is there any... Well, the easy solution is add some log rules on your PF box and find out what's matching which rules. Because the only pathological case I can think of is that the asterisk box is somehow sending the internal IP address out the external interface, which then hits the PF box, doesn't match the usual rule, and gets NATed.
Asterisk box only has one interface. It's got two IP addresses on it.
Oh, then yes, that's probably exactly what's happening. Because it'll bind... Yeah. There's no... When you've got multiple IPs bound to a single interface, and you don't expressly specify which sub-interface you're binding to, the socket call, or the connect call, sorry, will just non-deterministically pick one.
Yeah, because it by default binds to 0000, which is any.
Yep.
It comes up to inadd or any, which will be round robin based on the last lookup.
Would change
so
hardware recently do something like that?
No.
If you add a router or change a board with a Mac ID on it?
We'll just add another interface, I guess, on that. Just have another connection to it.
Yeah.
Maybe go.
Yeah, basically, or the other solution, this is a Linux box, right, running Asterisk?
In this case,
yeah,
CentOS again.
Add a /32 route to your target IP address, specifying that interface's IP address, public IP address, as the next hop route, and that should force it to always send packets out that IP. That actually takes advantage of a
right.
side effect in the...
But that then will bypass the internal stuff if they use that as an external route, right?
No, a /32 route, so it only affects traffic destined to less, I assume.
Yeah.
Not for the full /24, that would break things. But if you do it for the full /32, Linux kernel will try and find that next hop, figure out which interface to send it out, realize that it is itself... and then go through a short circuit process and actually just send it out with that IP address. That's the quick and dirty workaround. There are better ways to solve it. But the better ways to solve it is reconfigure Asterisk to bind to the correct interface. And I'm not sure how to do that.
Isn't it just a listen line?
Do you need Asterisk to use both interfaces?
It's outbound.
Because I'm home of a Wi-Fi and it's internal, right? Outside, then they use the external address, but they have the same name, right?
I don't know.
I don't either.
It's not supported.
Hasn't been quite well in the past, but
I found the one. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
I found the one I was talking about. It's called The Coming War on General Computing. It was at the bottom right of page
Cory
Doctorow.
Yeah, it's Cory Doctorow.
All right.
Yeah, it's a good video.
It was a very good video. And, like, if we had a link to a video like that every month, it would be a great thing if somebody finds something they could, like, send to.
I have a perfect solution. Send us a link.
Okay. It's just that when we got the printed version, you would have never gone and typed that in, but when you get the electronic version, it's so easy to just click on it. The first time I did, it was one of the most interesting videos I've watched in a long time.
Well, that's a funny one. I'm not about to include the whole transcript in the newsletter, so, yeah.
Well, the other thing is that this takes you to 28C3 and all their conferences that happened in December. And there was a lot of really good lectures that went on there. So, like, this was a great link to include on the newsletter. I want to say thank you.
Okay. All right. Kudos to Catherine on that one. She was editing that issue.
Just like all the newsletters, the more contributions people make, the better it is.
Okay.
Because usually it's just one of the board members at their last minute scrambling to find information. Occasionally we contribute to each other, but... for the most part, if you guys find something in a month, just fire it off to board. Like, every suggestion we get helps.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's almost always a huge seminar every month. Like, Google holds their huge seminar. Well, last year was in May. This year, I hear it's going to be in June or maybe July, possibly. Okay. But there's always seems to be some big seminar that we could, like, link to their videos, and a lot of them are streaming all of their video content now.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of someone who edits about one newsletter a year... We don't necessarily know that you're interested in that.
Oh, okay.
Hint, hint.
Like, seriously, the more contributions, the better.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for the feedback.
Yeah, thank you. We appreciate that.
Yeah.
Any other questions, comments?
Question. Anybody else tried to install Linux on an EFI system yet? And have you successfully dual-booted it with anything else?
No. I have run the virtual machine under it.
No.
In other words, it's an Ubuntu machine.
Yeah.
So that's the answer is no, I guess. That's the real answer.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's a challenge. I understand it's a challenge. I was happy to get one working.
Actually, do your EFI machines boot any faster?
Definitely not. No.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, because it's that server board.
Oh, so. Okay.
I'm doing this on a little ThinkPad, and it boots Ubuntu in about 24 seconds, you know, from dead off to...
Okay, that's fast.
Okay. That's it's pretty good.
That's with an SSD.
Right. But it's still fast.
Okay. Is there some specific challenge to dual boot? I've heard that single boot is complicated. What problem is presented for multiple lessons?
Both are challenging. Mainly because although Intel, pardon me, very clearly defined the UEFI spec, no one seems to have read it. So HP and Lenovo, for example, are making and shipping BIOSes that don't even comply, that boot non-compliant hard disks, that support weird bastardized hybrid partition table layouts, and not just the protective MBR, but like truly screwed up partitioning, and it still boots. That's how HP is shipping their Elite series PCs now. Ubuntu and Fedora both get the file system type wrong when they create an EFI partition. It's an unending series of, you know, didn't anybody actually read the spec before they started coding? And obviously the answer is no, they didn't. If you have a Windows 7 machine that shipped from the factory with an EFI boot partition and you install Ubuntu on it, you will no longer be able to boot the machine. Guaranteed. Fedora isn't quite so destructive. I think Fedora just fails to install. So, yeah, and if you drop to the shell in the middle of your install, you can make it happy. Well, that's getting a bit ridiculous.
Okay, give it another 6 months.
But there are some incompatibilities with Grub.
Yeah.
Grub 2 apparently is also not terribly, terribly stable, which doesn't help matters any. And although you can use what's the EFI version of Lilo called?
Eli-Lo? Yeah.
Well, that was too easy. Although Eli-Lo apparently works well, half the tools in Ubuntu don't know that Eli-Lo exists, and they expect to see Grub, and like it's just, it's a mess right now.
Yeah.
Single booting works because the BIOSes don't really comply, so they don't care that Ubuntu creates a non-compliant partition layout anyway, and most of them just boot. But, yeah, it's...
And what's the advantage of keeping it EFI?
Because that's all you get on most modern systems.
It's not an option.
Yeah. Because EFI replaces the BIOS.
Right.
And it's still on a chip, though, right? Not on the,
right.
on the hard disk.
Well, yes and yes. EFI replaces the BIOS, but instead of loading the track 0, which is your master boot record, or sector 0, which is your MBR, the BIOS now has enough intelligence to go look at the partition table, find the EFI boot partition, launch a shell, read the file system, find the boot catalog, open the boot file, and then display something to you on screen. So, like, yeah, it's good. It takes a lot from open firmware, if you've ever used the old RS6000s or an old PowerPC. It's very similar in concept. Your BIOS now has a little mini OS in it, basically.
And it gives you a shell. It's pretty slick, actually.
Yeah. But
and a Linux-like shell, or a Unix-like shell, not a DOS-like shell.
But yeah, it's a pain. The one, actually, I'll be demonstrating it later. EFI booting VMware is unbelievably fast. So that's one place where I've run into it lately.
That's it for this podcast. Thanks for listening. For more mug meeting summaries or for more information about the Manitoba Unix User Group, check out our website at muug.mb.ca.